Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have a great comment to share with all of you today, and I really do love these comments when they come in. And this comment is from Australia, and this guy knows me a little bit, so he has the liberty of calling my name. He says, Mr. Leap, thank you for your series on T.E. Lawrence. You are inspiring so many thoughts and opportunities for growth in a true hero which shape the current world we live in. I now understand much more about some key countries in the Middle East. I thought I would research more about Michael Korda, the author, and I found this fantastic YouTube with him talking about his book on T.E. Lawrence. And here it is, and this is the link, by the way, listeners, if you would like to turn there, and I have. It's really a kind of a fabulous video. So here's the address. It's https://youtube.be/alebavglb-1. So I think if that doesn't get you there, if you just type in Michael Korda's discussion of T.E. Lawrence, you'll be able to find that video. Anyway, it is worth seeing. Now, he goes on to say to me, he says, if you have not seen this video, please watch the full version. He talks a lot about additional information about T.E. Lawrence not in his book. He said it's really fascinating, and I have to agree with him all the way. So he says, thank you for all of your effort, and I look forward to hearing your voice again next week. Take care, and that is from Australia. So I really like those comments when they come in, especially when they're really excited about what we're doing. Well, over the last several programs, I felt it necessary to discuss a short list of the major British players behind the scenes of all the actions taken by Lawrence as he really just began to study the Arabic readiness to take down the Ottoman Empire. I mean, that was a big challenge for the Arabic peoples. Now, after a few new programs, we'll discuss the Arabic cast of characters and some more British not included on the first list. Now, I have to practice the Arabic names. I mean, they're different. So I want to practice that and then do a little bit more research. Now, when I was reviewing the last program, I realized I probably could have been a little clearer about Lawrence's private meeting with Khalil Pasha. Now, I think I mentioned just a little bit about it, and again, we're going to come back to this in another program. But just to clear up the matter, it says, I made a little note to myself, and I'll just read this. It says, the Turks, had been winning this battle at Kut, and the British army was really ready to, I guess they were really ready to surrender. And what they thought they'd do is they knew to get their troops out of there. I think there were still about 10,000 troops in there. What they did is they sent someone from Parliament, and they sent Lawrence in to kind of bribe the Turks to let the British army go, and what they called it, paroled from their loss and, of course, their surrender at Kut. Now, of course, Khalil Pasha, he didn't agree to it. They came back several times. Actually, the price went from $1 million worth of gold coins to $3 million, and he still wouldn't do it. So essentially what they did is the British had to surrender, and then what they did is they marched those prisoners, and they became prisoners of war. They marched them to these war camps, and it was so violent and vicious. The death toll for the British was enormous. And again, remember, there was both British and there were Indian from the Indian Empire, or from the British Empire there. And I said, we'll talk about that more in a future program, but it really was quite tragic, and it just shows, let's say, how much involved Lawrence really was in the Middle East. Now, today I am really thrilled to have the 60-plus panel back with me in the studio. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you.
She's been off vacationing. You know, not really, but she's been off the program. And then I also want to introduce James Brandon, who I've been promising for months is going to come on. But James Brandon is here today, and he's going to sit in on our panel from time to time. So welcome, James.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, James is a high school instructor of English literature at our Imperial Academy. And I guess we should now call this the 60-plus-1 panel from now on, since James is not even close to 60 yet. So maybe he's halfway there.
Almost.
But, yeah. But I've known James for a long time, and he's really a great guy. So what I thought we'd do today is we'd just dive right into Quarters Chapter 2. So maybe I could just say, to get this started off, I just think that Corda is a masterful writer. I mean, the thing is, when you pick up a biography, I expect to, you know, start at their birth, and then you end up with the great things they did kind of in the middle of the book. But essentially what he does is he takes us right to the middle of the book in the first couple chapters. And so he talks about this in that lecture that I got to watch. So what are both of your impressions of the book so far before we get into the meat of this today? So what do you think so far? I think it's a thrilling book. I was glad he took us right into the middle of the action.
Yeah, I'm really loving reading it. You know, going back and reviewing it. I've been done for a little while now and just reviewing it, bits of it again in prep for today. And I've found it fascinating because I think as far as my historical knowledge, World War One is a fairly gaping hole. I think I've read a lot more about World War Two, and so it's been fascinating for me. The first couple chapters took me a really long time to go through because I was stopping all the time and was looking up even names of people. I'm just not as familiar with the players and the personalities, and so I think it's done a great deal for me, just forcing me to learn more about something that I think probably didn't learn enough about in my history classes in high school and things. So I've loved it from that perspective, but even what you were saying about the way that he writes the story, just bringing you right into the action. Someone who's a fairly mythical character in history and kind of peeling back the layers, but starting, like you said, right in the middle of it in a really complicated situation, and then going back to the childhood, and then going back to the family life, and you start to, I think, understand a little bit more about why Lawrence is the way that he is.
Yes, yeah. So I'm kind of enthralled with it, but I agree with you. I've had to do more research. I mean, you read like five pages, and I thought, wow, I don't know any of that, so I've got to go back. And even when I was in high school, I don't remember us covering World War One. At all, you know.
And not the Middle East theater.
No. I remember studying the Africa rebelling against the British Empire. That's the kind of history we had when I was in high school. So, Deborah, what do you think?
Well, I'm along with both of you folks in terms of I had to read a little and then look things up as I went along because I felt like I don't have any idea what he's talking about sometimes. So it's been really, really good from that standpoint. But it's always just the European European fighting and talking about the trenches. That's all I remember from World War One. But we didn't learn anything about the Middle East at all. So it has been very, very interesting for that reason. But then also the way he writes is very colorful in terms of describing some of the scenes, and that's it, really interesting. We'll get into that, I'm sure.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. So the thing that I'm really happy about is it seems like it's bringing the Middle East today alive for me, you know, because a lot of things especially for Americans, you know, I think we believe history began with us. And we also think that geography begins with us, you know. I mean, we have been blessed to be part of the superpower. So a lot of people want to live here still. But, the thing is that I'm just so impressed with is I think I understand now a little bit more what's going on in Syria, and I think I understand a little bit more what's going on, let's say, with Saudi Arabia and things like that that I really didn't grasp before. And also, even the way Russia still wants to get its hands in the Middle East. And so it's really kind of interesting to have the background. And I know that Mr. Gerald Flory and I, when we were sitting down to kind of, draft out these programs, he said, you know, we really need to do something on Lawrence so that people understand the Middle East. And I can't wait to tell him in our next meeting how glad I am he asked me to do this book, because now I know more about the Middle East than I did before. So let's talk about, again, we wanted to dig into chapter two, the taking of Aqaba, because it really, this is where his legend begins. I mean, this is where the legend of T.E. Lawrence really begins, the taking of Aqaba. But I think we should really talk a little bit about the Sykes-Picot Agreement before we even get into the whole chapter. So I had no knowledge of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And even when I started to read the first chapter of the book, I didn't really begin to understand it. But James, you could go ahead and just start with that, and I'll just chime in with the rest of you on that. So what you know about the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating, I don't even want, calling it a tidbit is doing it a disservice, because it really, I think, has set the foundation for the way that the Middle East is today. And it's very revealing, I think, and helps you understand some of the tensions there. Essentially, some of the allied nations there in World War One, specifically in this case, the UK and France and Russia, basically got together, and they were all involved in that Middle Eastern theater, and they got together and hashed out their intent for this region, and basically treated the Middle East as a spoil of war. And in order to sort of guarantee each other's help, they agreed upon areas that would be divided up amongst the three of them. And the difficulty, the difficult part of this in looking back historically, was that they needed the Arab help. They needed to get the Arabs on their side with the Arab revolt and everything involved in that and the players in that. But they also could not reveal to them their full intent with this agreement, because places that the Arabs were fighting for, thinking that they were going to be the recipients of these cities and these areas, the English, the French, the Russians had already pre-agreed to parcel many of those places out to each other. So kind of behind the back of the Arabs, agreeing to sort of slice up the pie ahead of time.
Right. So it was secret. It was a big secret. And I think one of the things that kind of is shocking to me, some of it I can understand, but the thing is that it was kept secret. And even I don't think even Lawrence understood it at the beginning, but then he began to understand more, especially when I forget which parliamentarian came to him. We'll figure this out. We'll have to talk about this more. But one of the parliamentarian guys came and talked to him about it and explained it better to him. And, Lawrence is actually pretty clear in the book, and I think Korda does a great job of portraying it, that he identified with the Arabs. He really tried to look at everything from their standpoint. And of course, we talked about this in an earlier program, where they wanted like a pan-Arabian country, and that they wanted the Middle East to be theirs, and they wanted Damascus as their capital. And even when he first meets Faisal, and Faisal knew immediately that he understood the Arab mind, and it really kind of molded their relationship there. But the thing is, I think it just... this whole Sykes-Picot Agreement really shows what happens when politics gets involved. The British wanted to maintain control of the Suez Canal. And of course, you can see that. But even we even know biblically that God had already given the British control of the Suez Canal, but they somehow had to get their political fingers into it. And I know someone else even says, I was reading, that they had a lot of interest in oil. They wanted to make sure the oil kept flowing, into the empire. And, of course, the empire was really kind of taking its gasps of its last breaths anyway. And so I could see the need to keep the Germans out of the Suez Canal. But the British really wanted to keep the Suez Canal open so they had better access to India. And so that was their main thrust there. And so which means that they wanted to control Palestine or Jerusalem, and they wanted to control all the so-called Christian holy places because they felt it was Christian and they had the obligation to do that. So that's kind of fascinating to me. All right. I think the other thing that we need to talk about is all this desire by the French, it was underneath the surface. All the desire for the British was underneath the surface. Eventually, when the Dardanelles happened and the Russian Empire kind of fell out of the war and really damaged them, that the British did not win the Dardanelles, then actually they cut them out of the secret convention too. I mean, they just cut Russia out. So.
Yeah, they hated the Bolsheviks anyway, so it was kind of a convenient excuse, I suppose, to get rid of the Russians. One less person to divide the pie between.
Right. So, but I, one of the things that kind of impresses upon me is that really greatly affected the winning the battles against the Turks. I mean, they were. It's kind of like they wanted to do it, and they wanted the Arabs to do it, but they wanted to make sure they were ensuring their own interests at the same time. So I think what's impressive is Lawrence saw through it all, and he's the only one that knew how to win.
One thing I think Korda does a good job of illustrating in the book, even using Lawrence's own words, is how much this disturbed Lawrence the whole time that he was fighting, and how he really struggled with the knowledge that he had. Like you've mentioned, he never did reveal this to any of the Arab leaders at the time. He did keep it secret, but it did eat him up, the fact that he knew that, you know, he supported both causes in one sense and believed that, but also believed that the Arabs deserved Damascus and knew that they were not going to get it. And so that did weigh very heavily on him.
Right. But I also think it led him to go against his military commanders. I mean, I still think he worked so hard to set the Arabs up to be able to take Damascus. And, of course, I think we're going to see that as we get into the book even more. All right. So in this chapter, Aqaba, let's now talk a little bit about, for our listeners out there, why Aqaba was so important. And I'll just go ahead and let you, James, give you a chance to spout what you think first there.
Okay. I mean, if you just look at a map, I mean, you can't really do that with radio, I suppose, show people a map. But if you can pull one up, you see just from looking at the location of it, you can tell that it would be strategically important. I mean, it was not a very well-developed town at the time, aside from the fortifications facing the sea, but strategically a really important area right there on the Red Sea, you know, right at the mouth there, right close to, Suez. And
Suez Canal, right.
So just a very strategically important place. And the British were incredibly worried about what could happen if this were to – I mean, the Turks had it at the time, but they were worried about what could happen if, you know, Germans moved. I don't know how reasonable or feasible it was, but they did have concerns about some sort of German naval base. The possibilities of that,
right.
And just, you know, basically a port on the Red Sea, where if they were to sort of stretch their army thin through that area, you know, Turkish army, the Ottomans or Germans, if they came down there, could easily be resupplied, quickly resupplied from this port there that was, again, well-defensed and very difficult, a very difficult strategic object to take as an opposing army, unless you did, which we'll get into, so I don't want to spoil it, but unless you do what Lawrence did. So again, something that was would have been very beneficial. And the interesting thing to me in looking at the way that Korda describes it is that Lawrence was really one of the only ones that understood how important it was.
Right.
Everybody else was really focused on sort of the high profile targets, Aleppo, Damascus. And so this, even though it's, you can sort of in hindsight see how important it was, Lawrence was the strategic mind down there that saw it and realized we need to take this one first before we can do the others. We can't go to Damascus. We can't go to Aleppo unless we have this.
Right, right. I think it's funny because he was a Oxford-trained archaeologist and mapmaker, but yet he had studied all of this military history. I think Korda brings out a good point. And again, I do think, and you could correct me here, either one of you, I do think the British were having so much trouble in Europe. You know, they were just getting slaughtered constantly. It's kind of like they had a half-hearted approach to the Middle East. They didn't want to throw everything at it because they were being forced to throw everything at what was happening in the fields of France. And so I do think, you know, fighting a war on two different fronts is always divisive, and it always causes problems. And that's what happened to Hitler in World War II when he had he was fighting in Europe, but he was also fighting in Russia, and that really, you know, did him in. But I think Lawrence could see they were kind of half-hearted about it. And on page 60 of the book, in the middle of the page, it says, and I think this is even so important for us to learn, and even... you know, Mr. Stephen Fleury's talked about this on Trumpet Daily. Of course, Mr. Gerald Fleury talks to all of us here about leadership. But it says here in the middle of the page, it says, Lawrence was among those who saw that it was necessary to go on the offensive rather than to sit and defend coastal enclaves. As long as October 1916, Faisal had considered moving the Arab base of operations to Wedge, 180 miles north of Yenbo, but he had hesitated, reluctant to put too much distance between his army and Mecca. In addition, moving the Arab army out of one tribal area to another produced endless difficulties. And we're going to talk about that some more, if not today. We'll talk about it in the next program. But you see, the British weren't really committed. Faisal wasn't really committed. And Lawrence says, we've got to do something. We've got to go on the offensive. We can't just sit around and wait for the Turks to come after us. And then he came up with this whole idea of taking Aqaba. And, you know, it gave, to me, from my understanding, it gave the Arabs advantage because they could move quicker into Damascus. I think Damascus is only about 104 miles away. And remember, if you've read the chapter clearly enough, the Arabs wanted to go right to Damascus. They wanted to go in there and take it. He knew they couldn't do it. They didn't have the regimental sense to do it. But I think it also gave the British a port city, which they weren't even thinking about, you know. So I do think that says a lot about Lawrence. And, you know, I also believe that Aqaba was a hard place to take because the Turks were using German guns, and the guns were facing the sea. And what's really kind of amazing about this whole taking of Aqaba is they had to take it from the desert. And no one would even consider going after that place from the desert because they considered it too hard to do. So I just think that kind of, shows us the genius, you know, of Lawrence. And again, I think in this chapter, there's a really funny little cartoon of him when Allenby shows up here. Allenby is this huge British, you know, the really bull. Important military figure, and there's a 5'5", you know, blonde, blue-eyed guy dressed in Arabic dress, you know, standing on the platform. And so, but we'll talk about this a little bit later too. But Allenby really liked him. They really got along. He liked his nerve.
they had some pretty core things in common, despite some glaring differences.
Right, right. So anyway, well, let's talk a little bit about the geography, and I think this is really important, especially if you as a reader out there are going to understand why taking Aqaba was such an important thing. You have to understand the geography and, you know, fighting in the desert. But you know what? I just looked at the clock, and the clock is telling us that's all the time we have for today's program. So it always goes so fast. All right, so next time we'll continue with this chapter on Aqaba. And remember, for this current series of programs, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can certainly buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. Now, please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. And I have neglected that site for a little while, so I'll be getting back on that now that we're coming to the end of our school year. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.